apprentices under you, they can understand how you speak in your technical terms.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't do that to someone who's never apprenticed under you, because, you know, as you're working, you're talking the techniques of basketry, and you use technical terms you wouldn't use in a class. And so, like, S and Z twist, and then, and other terminology, and you could explain to them what you're doing, and they could visualize it where, if they had never apprenticed with you, they couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm. And it's really fun to share that excitement, too.
It is, because to have somebody to share it with, because especially when I had, when my mother was teaching, there was she and I, and it really didn't progress very much under her, even though she was really a good teacher, and I don't know why. I think people were intimidated because she was really, she wouldn't let people experiment on their own. And when people experiment, I really like it, because she was a traditionalist. You did it one way, and you didn't deviate. In fact, she'd get really annoyed with me, because the first time I did it, I was with Flora Mather, and I learned how to do Cynthia and reading. And my mother was so angry. She said, you're Haida. Well, how could you learn Cynthia and reading? And I wouldn't even answer her. It was just, I had a drive to just learn all these things. Because there were only old people doing these things. And it was so, I felt it was really urgent that something had, you know, that was going to be lost. And because the basket I have up here was given to me by a collector. And that's when I really started taking basketry. But I had been taught.
The one in the middle there?
Yeah, and I have always helped my mother collect,
is red cedar?
No, this is from the Salette.
What is that?
They're a tribe in Oregon. It's actually a conglomerate of different Indians who weave. And this man, who was a collector, wrote and he wanted one of my mother's hats. So I, because she didn't write, I had to write the letter and correspond with him about this hat. And so he bought her hat, and then I was really surprised. He said he was so thrilled that he could get a hat, so he was sending me this as a gift for the in-between person.
Mm-hmm.
And then he wrote this really, I know I have it somewhere, but I don't know where it is. And he put it in that Ida was 92, and he was so afraid because there was no one else learning, and he was afraid she would die and no one would have passed on the Salette basketry technique. How do you spell Salette?
S-I-L.
I have so many basketry books, you think I have. S-I-L-E-N-T-Z, I think.
Okay.
Not really sure.
Okay, I can look it up. That gives me an idea.
Right.
Oregon.
Right.
Interesting. So the woman who made this basket was virtually the last basket.
Right, but I later learned that someone else learned from her.
Yeah.
And so it was really, because I was talking in Seattle at the Snow Goose Gallery. There was an opening of a show of Edna Jackson, Cheryl Samuel, and myself. Mm. And I was talking about this, you know, how I got into basketry, and this person in the audience said, well, you know, it kept on because somebody did take a class under her, did study with her. But, so that's why I was learning all these different methods, and I still think, well, there's, you know, in our tribe, the Skittigats lost how to weave. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't weave. They want people to come there and teach them to weave.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the south of Massachusetts, the southern part of Queen Charlotte. And the Haidas here were still weaving, but they were kind of really influenced by the Tlingit. And so there was two ways of weaving in the Haida. But as I was teaching basketry and going to different regions, it was really interesting to find out that the Tlingit, like Ernestine Glessing showed me one way of weaving. Esther Littlefield showed me. There was another woman, Annie Jacobs, she showed me another way to weave. It was really interesting to see that they all wove a little different. Even though they were weaving right side up, their technique of holding it or the way they treated the fiber was so different. So I know that Indian people actually probably all had very little variation to the way they held it, the technical differences. So I really wish that someone who spoke Sangha, like Nora Downhower, could go to these older people, the ones that are still alive, because there's still a few, especially in Yakutat, and maybe in Hoonah, I don't know, but I know in Yakutat there are still some older people alive. And it would really be interesting to go to these different, not so much I think it's the house they originated in, if they were originated from the frog house or the whale house, because that's what I'm finding. But that would be up to the person who was doing the research, and I really wish, but Nora is so afraid the language is dying that she's putting all her energy into that, and it's too bad, and I wish there was somebody who could do it in Basque, because there is a really difference, and I think what it had to do with was, I know this is where my mother used to weave, and when people would walk in, any visitors, and she was weaving, she would immediately cover it with a nice clean white cloth.
Whatever she was weaving?
Right, and then she'd put it away. But I think it had to do with not being secretive, but showing respect to another human being. You know, you always treated a human being with great respect, and they would no more think of sitting there and weaving like we do. We keep watching TV when somebody walks in, or knitting or whatever we're doing. Especially if they were my mother's guests, she'd get really annoyed with me, because sometimes when she had guests come and they sat over there and talked, I'd make myself a cup of tea and I'd sit there and drink it. And after they leave, she'd say, Dolores, how could you do that to another human being? And I'd say, well, what? What did I do? And she'd get really annoyed. She'd say, you really don't know what you did? Huh. And I'd say, well, she was your visitor. She wasn't mine. And she'd say, Dolores, she's another human being. Oh. If you have tea, you don't drink it there by yourself. You share it. Whatever you have, you share it. So I think they would have shared their basketry knowledge, but I think that when they did basketry, it was, you know, to show respect to the person. That's why I think it almost got lost. Simply because when they were weaving and somebody walked in, they just stopped.
And it wasn't a traditional thing to pass on what you learned? I mean,
well, it was, but for instance, my mother learned from her mother-in-law, but even her mother-in-law didn't want to teach her. When when she was a child growing up, she lived with her grandmother a lot, and her grandmother did a lot of weaving. But her grandmother wove in a room separate, and I can understand that, because it's so much fun to weave, you don't want to be interrupted by anything.
Yeah,
maybe that's what they did even then. Maybe they, because you see pictures of Haida women, and they're always solitary. You see pictures of fingered women weaving. There's always children sitting there weaving. So I think that the Haidas were more private about what they were doing than sharing it with children around. Because I know that always happened, even when we went out after seaweed, you know, so we were told to play on the beach. They'd say, you know, they'd keep an eye on us. We could play on the beach running in with the tide, because the tide was usually out when we got seaweed. And they kept an eye on us, but we weren't made to pick seaweed. They treated the land with such respect that I don't think they wanted children. Because when we grew older, like when I became a teenager, they'd tell me, you know, don't harm the seaweed. Hold it when you're on the rock. Don't try and jerk it. Twist it and turn it. And one time I came after I had been away, and I thought I'd use a scissor. And the old women, they were so superstitious, they came and they said, you know, you can't do that. I said, the way we learned it is how you do it, because if you do something like that, you cut it with something sharp, and it'll die and it won't grow there again. And it was interesting, later on, when I took a class about plants and botany, and found out that the seaweed is a very prehistoric plant, and if you pull it out of the roots, it won't grow there again. So it was interesting. They must have learned that from their own experience. Probably somebody pulled, you know, and then cleared an area and there was no more. So then from then on, the only way you did it was in such a way that, you know, you didn't jerk or yank at it, and children weren't allowed to get seaweed. I mean,
they'd be too impatient.
Right. And even with digging clams, we didn't dig the clams. Our parents dug the clams like a started. We did Fraser Clint commercially on the Queen Charlotte. And when our parents were digging the clams, we had little buckets there, and they were woven seaweed baskets, or they were clam baskets. And we would have little ones, not the big ones the adults had, but we'd have to run back and forth. There was, you know, there's, you know how big the tides are.
Yeah.
They run out very far.
Uh-huh.
And so my parents would dig clams, and they would put it in a bucket, but we'd run with our little buckets, you know, sometimes two of them, and we'd pour the clams into our buckets, into our clam baskets, and then we'd run and put it into the box where the commercial truck came and had a little tag inside, and the commercial truck came and picked them up. But we didn't dig, but when we did learn to dig when we were teenagers, it was really interesting because two years ago when I was teaching a harvesting class on the Queen Charlotte, I couldn't stand it. Here I was supposed to be teaching harvesting spruce root gathering, and I saw the commercial diggers out on the beach, so I walked out. And there was a young man who was digging clams and kept breaking the shells. And so I said, "What are you doing?" I said, didn't your mother or your father or your aunt tell you how you dig? And he said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Look, there's a hole." I said, "The little tiny hole like that, when it doesn't have a little pyramid around it, means that it's only a hand length down. It's not far down. But when it builds a pyramid, that clam has had to suck in, and it's deep, and it's built this little pyramid and has had to, you know, dig down into the sand, so this little pyramid is around it. And if that pyramid is high on one side here, it means he's traveling this way."
Huh.
And he didn't know that. Mm-hmm. And so even those little traditional things that were taught to us as children were not passed on to this generation of teenagers. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know what else we've lost in not teaching our children. And I was really surprised because that was so emphatic when we were children. To know, you know, you don't want to hurt, you don't want to break the shell because it's not, it gets sand into the flesh and you don't want broken clams.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. I'll let you do the interview. No, it's great. I mean, I want this all to be your voice and your voice, so that's great. But I want to know, I have read just a little bit about you, and you learned or started to weave very late, actually. It was in 72.
Right. Well, I took a class from my mother when I was a small child. She taught basketry in the village.
Mm-hmm.
And
where was that?
In Mastiff on the Queen Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
And she kept telling everybody, you know, to make a cylindrical basket, your first basket has to be cylindrical. You can't taper in, you can't taper out, because you have to learn to control it. And so my basket tapered out, and she kept saying, "Dolores, take it undone. You have to have a basket that goes straight up and down." And I just wouldn't listen to her. She was my mother. Who, what does she know? I was going to take it undone, so I kept doing it. And then the teacher found out that there was going to be a contest of different Indian arts and crafts in schools, and it was going to be held in Victoria. And so she filled out the application, and my mother said, "Don't send Dolores, because it's really terrible, and I don't want her to feel bad when everybody else if gets a ribbon or something nice happens. I don't want her to feel bad about it." And the teacher said, "No, all the children are equal in this class. Hers goes too." So mine went, and you wouldn't believe it. I won first prize.
Oh, boy.
And she was very mad. She said to the white teacher, she said, "You know what? It's because they didn't know about basketry."
Mm.
She said, "If they didn't know that, the first basket technically has to be straight up and down." And so she said, excuse me. Paula. When the $5 came, and that was really lots of money in the 30s, and when the $5 came, my mother said to the teacher, she said, Dolores can keep the blue ribbon, but she cannot keep the $5, because she's not the best.
Mm-hmm.
And it would really be sad if the person who did the best basket didn't get the prize.
Mm-hmm.
So the teacher agreed to that, so they gave the $5. And I was really angry. I threw the basket down. I'll never do basketry. I don't even like baskets.
How old were you?
I must have been about 8 or 9,
something
like that. but I was really, I had a really bad temper anyway, and I just said, just don't ask me to do it again. And I wouldn't, and so as I grew older, she used to live here, and then when her husband died, my husband had her move in with us, and she used to do basketry, and I was an accountant at Ketchikan General, and I would say to her, don't do red and yellow cedar baskets in here because it smells so terrible. And I go to the office and people say, what is that odor? And I don't want you to do it here. My husband would say, my husband was Caucasian, and he'd say, Mother, don't listen to her. The smell is wonderful. I love it. Don't stop weaving. And then when I was translating for her and this man wrote about this basket, this was in 72, and so my husband said, Dolores, you have to take that class. Even if I told him that I went to school in Canada and in Canada in seventh and eighth grade, they already tell you if you're university entrance material. Oh. You know, but the English system.
Huh.
You go vocational or you go university entrance. And in university entrance you take Latin, French, algebra, geometry, right. And so they already told me that. And that I couldn't, that usually they said people who got good grades, university entrance students, didn't usually do very good in art. And so they said, you know, so they took me out of art class and put me in art appreciation. And so I always assumed I was not good in art. Although, you know, when I was really a small girl, I must have been about six, maybe I was six, we were out with my grandmother, my brother and I. My grandmother took a plant, and I really wish I knew what plant it was, but the psychology of it is great. She took the plant, and she rubbed it in her hands, because she was really a good weaver, and she was good at doing things with her hands. And so she took it, and she rubbed the plant in her hand, and then she took my hands, and she rubbed it in my hand, and she said, you'll always be good with your hands. You'll always be able to do anything you want to do with them. Then she turned around and did that to my brother Victor. She rubbed her hands and got another plant and rubbed it and put it on his. And she said, don't forget this, because you'll, if you remember that you're going to be good at this, you always shall be. And so that, you know, so I always thought that I was good until they told me I was not, would never be an artist. And so, you know, I just quit taking any art classes. I wouldn't even... Never, you know, I never took any art classes in school. Even when I came to the United States, I would never take art because I just assumed, because the teachers in Canada said, you know, if you're university entrance material, you're not going to be a very good artist. So when my husband said, you should take this class, I said, well, you know I'm not an artist. I can't do that. And he said, well, look, he said, if you learn the techniques, you'll be able to pass it on. And that's important, not to learn that, not to lose that. He said, you have to learn it, you have to take the class. Well, we didn't tell my mother. I signed up at the community college, and first I had to ask the administrator because it happened that I was doing budgets right then, and she said, no, she didn't, there was no problem. Said, well, you always go scuba diving and you feel like it. Why are you asking me to take this class? So I really practically grew up with the nuns because I was 17 when I first started working with them. But anyway, so the sister said, you know, just go ahead. And so I took the class, but it was weird when I walked in the class, my mother said, she used to teach 22 students. I teach 12. I don't know how she did it, except she did it traditionally. Anyway, I walked in the class and she said, what you do here? I weave. You don't look. Please. And I thought, oh, I've never argued with her. I've never, you know, even as a teenager, in Indian, you don't argue with your mother. Mm-hmm. You know, when she says something, you may disagree, you may say something later, but when she tells you to do something, you do it. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, what am I going to do? And then the art director walked in. He saw how red I was. I just, you know, I didn't know how to, because the whole class is there, and there she is, chasing me out. And Ron Inouye walked in the class and he said, what's going on? I said, she said I can't take the class. And he said, he walked up to me, put his arm around my mother, and he said, Selena, we need her registration.
Good for him, huh?
And so she said, okay. But oh, did she ever give me a bad time? I would have to, I would, she let me weave and cross, but as soon as I got home, she'd say, take it all and done. And I'd have to do, she made me do that basket. I don't know how many times I did it over and over and over again. It was terrible. I
mean, did she make you start out with the straight cylinder
right.
thing again?
Uh-huh. And she made me do that one like 5 times before she ever let me do anything that went out or in or, and, but later on she encouraged me. It was really funny. I was telling her, she was going to Bethel and I would read every book on basketry, and I was reading a book on the Navajo School of Weaving, and I got some, I used yellow cedar and reed, and I made, and I had told her that I wanted to learn quilt weaving, and so she was going to Bethel, and I said, I want to learn quilt weaving, so why don't you learn how from the Eskimo, and you'll show me, and so she said, okay, she would try. Well, she went up there, and she said, she never had time, so she didn't show me. But I happened to be going to a meeting. I was still working at the hospital. I was still working as an accountant. And I was on my way to San Francisco. And I used to hate sitting in hotels in Seattle overnight because there weren't as much planes going then. You know, you'd have to overnight sleep properly. I waited for the plane, and that night I had bought this book on basketry. When I got into basketry, I was fanatic. I got this book on basketry, and I learned how to do this from the Navajo weaving book, and so it was really fun.
And this is really similar to Eskimo.
It is. So it was really fun. But that's how I got into basketry.
So once you got into it, you just really took off then.
Not really. She really, well, right at first she really didn't encourage me. I'll never forget one time. I finished the basket and my husband said, go show your mother. Go show your mother. That was really beautiful. I brought it to her and she was sitting here drinking tea and I gave her the basket. And she looked at it. She put it down and she kept drinking tea and then finally she said, nah, which means poor thing. And I knew she thought it looked terrible then, you know, because in a height of that, that's an expression when you don't know what to say. You want to be honest, but you don't want to be cruel. So you said, poor thing.
Was she talking about the basket or was she talking about you?
No, she was talking about the basket. It wasn't that good. And that was really one good thing. You know, it's really hard in the Indian culture, though. It's very hard for Indian people to, they don't, you know, oh, that's wonderful. They don't say things like that. And in fact, shortly before she died, I learned, well, I don't have the lid to it. I did this cylindrical basket. I have been doing, I don't know what I did with the lid. I did this cylindrical basket and, anyway, I learned this special ending when I was at the British Museum because they got a grant to study basketry there. And I learned this special ending. And on the lid, I wish I had it. I don't have the lid. I don't know what I did with it. And anyway, I learned to do that ending, and I was showing her, because we had looked at it, and we didn't know how it was done. And so I took a lot of notes, and then I learned to do it. But it took a lot of, I had to take it undone, take it out, take it undone. And then when I showed her, and she said, well, you're smart, all right. So that was the greatest compliment she ever gave me. But in a way, it's good because you know that when she says something like that, you know you're getting good.
Yeah. Well, do you think that she was harder on you because you were her daughter and she wanted
you
to be
the best? No, she was very hard on students. And that's why I really think that, like me, they didn't try to excel because there was never that... And I have a hard time. I have to really work at encouraging people who apprentice under me because I find that even though I'm really impressed, I won't verbalize it, but now I force myself to verbalize it. And in fact, I have some apprentices up in Juneau that I'm really proud of. And I have to keep telling them because they are so good and they're young and they're teaching their children.
Oh, that's great.
And so.
And are they Haida or are they Native?
Yes, they're Haida. And they do beautiful work. They're half white, the girls, but their mother was Haida. And in that, it's matrilineal, and so even it's my. In fact, effect when you see my granddaughter. She's blonde and blue eyed.
Uh-huh.
Well, her hair is almost your color.
Huh.
It's a strawberry one.
Huh? This almost looks like baleen. What is this?
Oh, it's spruce.
It is spruce.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll have to tell you the story about that basket. You can see this here is the natural dye. I use sulfur, mud, and iron. Bits of old iron. That's why it has that kind of sheen to it.
Yeah.
But the top is really shiny. Well, it was great to be in a traveling show. And this color had really faded. Any kind of dye, unless it's a mineral dye, it's really fugitive. And so this, even though this was a mineral dye with the iron oxide, really was fugitive and kind of faded out. So I took a magic marker and did it next.
Okay.
Pete Corey heard that, he'd kill me.
Well, that's funny, because I've tried tricks like that when I used to do printmaking, and maybe something didn't come out quite as evenly in color. If it was black, I'd take a magic marker and just kill it. I don't know, this is a real no-no, but...
Well, I think that in a museum, you couldn't possibly have it, because it would break down the fiber.
Uh-huh.
It would be really... even the iron oxide is very bad. It's just like with my Chilkat weaving. I did that with iron. That first one's iron oxide. You can see that it's bleeding and everything. Where this one I'm doing is it's a commission by Dr. Hoyt.
I think I read about this. Is this the one that was in Nan Elliott's book, the one that you were talking about, your dancer friend?
Right.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And you
That's
can
beautiful.
See it's you can see the color
is
going to but see by now I had quit doing my own dyeing and all that. I just use, I do this with this. I still make my own dye. You know, this is a dye maker. Her name is Isabel Tipson. She lives in Victoria. And she came up with the formula. And it is a dye made for wool. And it'll stay a lot longer than this that I made earlier. And it isn't as good a dye. That's a state by dye.
And
this is really magic when you're working with this kind of dye, when you've worked with Rick dye, and I've worked with natural dyes, and I got out of that because, you know, when you make berries and dyes, they're so fugitive, you can't hold them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but this is a dye from the yarn, I didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the black, no, I don't change the black like I used to. Over dye it and stuff, but I don't do that anymore.
What is this going to be?
This is going to be a ceremonial dance apron. Uh-huh. It'll be like that one. It'll come down and it'll have the your toes on it. I just finished up. I don't know whether you saw that from the white or that raven's tail.
No.
I made raven's tail.
Weaving, though, we were so interested in learning all the different arts, traditional arts and crafts. And did you do anything like this before? No. So it was just once you started, you learn how to weave, and just like your thirst for knowledge, and this just.
Well, I was like that with accounting. I was a really workaholic at the hospital. That's why I went scuba diving when I felt like it. And I took courses at the University of Chicago and with summers, and at the University of Colorado, and the University of Chicago in the late 60s got really bad. I just quit going there and went to the University of Colorado for summer courses. But I'm really driven. I'm a driven person.
Yeah, it sounds like it. What are you learning anything now?
What I'm doing right now is I really would like to go to the Smithsonian. I had this board made, and these sideways ovoids are very technically difficult. The rest of it looks really hard, but I can do any of these things. But these sideways ovoids, I'd love to go to the Smithsonian and learn how to do that. And the only way, and there's no one, Cheryl wrote the book, but the work that she does is great, but see, the only thing that's going to tell me how to do, because none of these are sideways ovoids. These are all lateral, and so I really would like to go to the Smithsonian and learn how to do this. And the only thing that they have that apron, and the only thing that will tell a story is looking at the back and really studying it. And that's really important.
So do they teach classes, or would it just be observation?
It would have to be just from my observation. Uh-huh. It would be just like learning, because there was no one that knew some of these endings that I have learned since. And a lot of the endings, my mother, when she did her basketry, you know, she either turned it out or, turned it out like this, or out like that, you know, or she just
turned it over.
Or she just cut the edge like this lady, see? Oh no, she turned hers. This is Lucy Raina. And this one is Laura Mason. When that picture was taken by Linda.
Oh, it's got a rattle in it.
Yeah.
What did you put inside for that?
That one had the spines from sea urchins and shells. The spines from sea urchins are hollow, so they make more noise than...
There's a rattle inside a rattle.
Right,
then.
Uh-huh. So they kind of echo. When Linda Gill was taking... was here taking this picture. I was working on it.
Is that you?
Yes. I don't like that picture. She did it for the Museum of Natural History, the Natural History magazine.
Okay.
And this is this blanket is at the museum, and my mother's hat is at the museum.
At the Museum of Natural History in New York, or here?
Well, this picture hangs in the Hammer Gallery in New York City. She painted it. It was at a show at the Smithsonian, and then I guess the Hammer Gallery bought it in New York City. So that's where it is.
This is a painting.
Uh-huh.
I see.
Yeah.
And you're immortalized then in painting, too. And who made the hat?
My mother made that. That's her last hat. She made one for me that's upstairs that she made before this. And you can really tell the difference. Like, by the time she made this one, her hands were getting weak. Studying techniques. Look at that.
Well,
she was always studying collections in museums. And
look at that.
Every one of them are different. She tried different things with all of them. She was really amazing. And she was always talking about how I study, but she did.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Well, I remember the first time that I ever saw her was at the museum, and she really was the one who gave me the inspiration to do this, but it took me all these years to actually put it together, but I so much wanted to come down here and talk to her. Well, tell me a little bit about gathering the materials, about the spruce root and the cedar bark, and how you go about that, and...
You gather the spruce roots usually in the spring, although in a mild winter like this, like Jack Hudson was teaching that class up here at the Heritage Center, and he needed some... And I said, no, there's a nice spruce root there. So he went out,
30 feet long? Maybe 15. I don't know. I know it's pretty long. Hmm. 18 maybe.
You took a big long root and just put the whole thing out. But how do you do it? I mean, are they pretty close to the surface? Do you just kind of look?
Yeah, they're feeder roots. Like in some areas where we get it, where there's moss, and then, you know, so there's either silky loam or there's sand, then it'll be shoot straight out and you just go out and get it.
Hmm.
And it's really better if you get it in the same place, you know, every second year.
Hmm.
You don't want to over harvest, but it's like pruning the tree. It'll send out more feeder roots, and so you have a lot to get, but if you allow it to just keep growing and growing, it'll be a big tangled mass.
Mm-hmm.
And so usually we go to almost the same places. We never get it on the same side of the tree.
How many feeder roots would a tree have going out?
There are thousands.
Oh, okay.
We only take like five or six, and then we go on. No, there are thousands. And then the other thing is really interesting. If you get it on one side of the tree, like say the prevailing wind comes this way, well, if the tree is being blown this way, the roots that come out here are much longer than the trees that are back here. And it's the same thing with the bark. The way that you don't want to get the bark on the side where the prevailing wind blows, because the bark will be really thick, where on the protected side where it faces the hill, it'll be nice and soft and not so thick and woody. So that it's the same thing with the roots. But there's a good article written by a man who was, I think they called him Silviculture from Juneau. He wrote an article. His name is Harris. He wrote an article about and did some research on what harvesting does to the tree, and he found out that it really doesn't harm the tree. I was really glad that article came out. And so I think it would make it easier for us to get roots, because I remember there was someone who was always teasing my mother, and it's day when these big windstorms came, he said, "Well, Selena, I know where you were harvesting. A big tree fell there."
So do you only go out at one particular season?
Best time is April, you know, late April, and then there's not a lot of new growth yet. It hasn't come up, and yet when you go out and get the root and you cook it, the outer casing, the part you don't use, very easily comes out. It just comes right out, so it's really nice.
If you get a big long root, then do you cut it into sections before you boil it?
We don't boil it. We cook it right in an open fire. You build a real hot fire, and it has to be really hot, and you just put, you use green sticks to, you know, you cut alder or some kind of green wood and just use it to cook the root.
So you just put the root right on top of the fire then?
You never let it get out of the stick. You have to keep turning it, because you don't want it to burn in any one place.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing, when you get it out of the ground, the little extra feeder roots that come out, you know, there's there's one root, but there's lots of little feeder roots that come off. The
hair.
Right, the little hair roots. Well, if you run your hand back, those that come off are okay, but if you try to pull the bigger ones, you'll have a burn there. So really, it's a good idea. If you get one that has a long hair, just leave it on when you cook it, because when you're doing your grating, you'll pull that extra, you know, hair that is an offshoot and isn't, you know, worth saving. You'll just take it and get rid of it. And some people do cut it into different grades when they're getting it, but I don't. I take it after I start splitting it in half. I'm splitting it into the layers that I'm going to use it in. Then I grade it, because if you grade it too far ahead, because sometimes the root will come and it'll get smaller as you go further off. But some roots are really amazing. They'll stay the same size
especially if they're a feeder root and they're not going to be an anchor root. Anchor roots, you can tell the difference. The bigger anchor roots just go to a small circumference, where the little feeder roots that are mainly, that are just going to be feeder roots, just stay there and stay the same circumference. So you can go out and you can get one 40 feet long and just keep falling. So it's incredible.
And what about, tell me about getting the bark.
Well, you get the bark in either early May. It depends on the weather. If we've had a hard winter, sometimes it's a little later. When we did our research in Great Britain, we had a bad experience because we went in April and we came back 6 weeks later. And when we came back, I went out to get some roots because it was like the latter part of May. And it was hard to pull off, so I thought, oh, they had a hard winter. Because it was snowing in Great Britain when we landed there. So I thought, I just assumed it was the same here. So I didn't ask anyone, and then I didn't go. And finally, about 2 weeks later, I went out and we couldn't pull the bark off. And I said, Jesus, I told Mother, I said, you're really strange. I said, I can't get the bark off. Nothing's happening. So we came home from trying to harvest, and I called one of my friends that does harvesting. I said, you know, I went out to try and harvest, and she said, yes, the season was very short. They had really warm weather from April on, and so the staff just flowed, and then it just stopped when it was stopping. And it was a really, I don't know why it was such a short season. And some years are like that. But usually you can get it May and June. In July, it's got too much pitch in it, the yellow cedar. The red cedar, you know, you can't get it off the tree. And there's a difference between red and yellow cedar. With the yellow cedar, you can get old trees. If they're harvesting for like totem poles, and they're going to use the yellow cedar for a totem pole, and the totem pole is 600 or 800 years old, you can still go and get that bark back, and it'll be nice and flexible and pliable. It's like leather. You can always use yellow cedar. But with red cedar, you don't want anything over 125 years old. It's really woody. It's woody under any circumstance. You know, when you're weaving with it, it's hard on your hands. There's nothing harder than spruces, though. My daughter is just finishing up a basket, and she's been using red and yellow cedar bark, and she said, now I know what you mean about spruces, because it does. It cuts your hands and makes them rough. In fact, if I'm doing chokeout weaving, which has to do with wool fiber, which catches any little snag on your hands or fingernails, you don't touch any other kind of weaving, because somebody would think, well, can you do cedar bark or spruce root weaving and then go back to your chokeout? No, you couldn't do it, because your hands get too cut up from this kind of fiber.
Even when it's all wet down and very pliable, it's
Right, you'll still get snags, it'll still cause the skin to, some breaks in your skin, and so you really can't do the two at the same time.
So what are you sending this off to your daughter in Hawaii?
Right, and she's going to complete she's going to do about 2.5 inches, 2 inches of this red and yellow, or yellow, whatever she decides on, and then she'll end it. And then my daughter that lives in Martha's Vineyard is going to do some Indian designs on it and paint it. Some of the roots, my mother, when she was ill, she knew in April that she didn't have much longer to live, but I had a lot of spruce roots that we had harvested, so she prepared a lot of roots for me. I couldn't, she told me to use it in my classes, but I had a suitcase full. That's really a trunk that I have not used yet, but we used some of her, this is her prepared material, this girl here. So there's some of her,
she's there too.
So it's kind of nice that, you know, I have that to fall back on. In fact, that basket, I'm doing a basket for the Eden Center, Eden Library, you know? and
this is the beginning of that. She did this. Mother did this. She started a basket, and because I weave a little finer than her, I did a three-string. The three-string, I ended her weaving, and this is mine right here. I'm going to do a cylindrical basket similar to that one. And, but I think this has a design last night.
Is that it there?
I'm doing a proposal for an apron for the Egan Library, too, in the raven's tail weaving, not choquette, the home of choquette. So this is this kind of just roughing it out of what I think this is a shaman hat design. This design. I love it. It's Kumsian, and you'll never see that design anywhere, not in anything that I've ever seen except the.
My grandma's busy right now. I'm having an interview, and I don't want to come out when I'm really hot. What are you doing? I can give you a call back.
What's your mother think about this house?
I don't know. It's very contemporary. So, and she really was not too impressed with contemporary things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't imagine. I did that one, and I can't imagine her ever looking at that and she'd really be upset.
Well, I don't suppose that any of the traditional hats or baskets were painted on either.
They
were.
Yeah, I have them also.
I've never seen any that have.
Yeah. I did this one shortly after.
It's like almost like a modern sculpture, I would think.
Yeah, I did it with, and even then she's in it because she probably wouldn't like it very much. This book, and I thought, well, she's not really here, but she still influences me in things I do, and I felt really very guilty for doing this modernistic piece. But she loved this design, which is fish flakes. Mm-hmm. That was one of her favorite designs, and I did it. But I was also influenced by Cheryl, so I put yarn fiber in here, which is yellow, which dashes through here, but you really can't see it because it's overwhelmed by the black.
Oh, I do see it.
And so, and some of the stories that the Haidas have is that when they first start weaving, they started with plating. They made mats, and so that's why I started this kind of like a bird basket, and some of the legends that I've read about in basketry from other tribes said that they saw birds making baskets, and so they were influenced by this. And this branch was blowing around after Christmas. It really went up this way, but I heated it and bent them back, and then just made a modernistic basketry thing, whatever it is. And it was really cute. So many people react so different to it. My grandson, he looked at it and he jumped up and he said, "All right." He really liked it. Yeah. And Bill Trudeau at the college, he's the acting director right now, and he really likes it. But some people look at it and they say, "Oh, why don't you? Why do you waste your time?" But I really enjoy doing things like that. In fact, when she was alive, I spun some cotton from the muskus with yellow cedar, and I wove it, and it was really pretty. It looked like I had the muskus with the cotton on it, and then I wove some yarn up above, and it was really fun. And my mother was here, she said, "Get rid of it."
So I got rid of it.
Mothers can be so funny sometimes.
I did another one, but
I don't know what the rest of it is. This artist, I can't think of his name right now, but his work, this reminds me of the things I've seen of his. He uses very kind of minimalistic branches, and then he'll do, you know, weavings and things on it, and, and he's very well known. And I can't think of his name. Would you know who I'm talking about?
No, I don't.
Okay, but
Is he from New York?
Well, I can't remember. I can't remember much about him except that
John, I'm talking to John.
John was really impressed with my work.
John, he's from
New York. Oh, no, John, he's from New York. And he was in Japan, so he has gardens where he bends the trees, too. So he really was impressed with the way I shape these things.
Yeah.
You know, I took branches, this is yellow cedar, and I took the branches and I heated them and twisted them and turned them and made kind of, I don't know, sculpture. And really had a lot of fun doing it. And it doesn't even matter how you place these things. You know, they look good whichever way you place it.
Well, the predictions of your grandmother really came true then.
I really enjoyed that picture. And at first, you know, I really didn't consider myself an artist. And then when I started really going into all these things, I thought, wow, you know, nobody, like people have such a hard time with Chilcat, and I really have a gift for it. I know I'm an artist. I know, I look at pieces that people make, and I'm so terrible. I think, oh, wow, I am an artist.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy it. And you can even tell from my first apron, like my ovoids are so much better. They're so much, so, look at that ovoid. It's, you know, it's square on one side and round on the other, and they should be the same like the one is.
Oh, that is.
There's such a difference. My lines are so much more, they're spontaneous. Just flows into one another. But it really had to do with influence from other people too, because when I did this one, you know, I started here on the side, because some pictures you'll see that some of them were woven from, like, there's a book of a weaving at the, in fact, there's a weaving, partial weaving at the Field Museum in Chicago. And you can see that they started not centrally. But you know, when I started this one, I was telling Esther Littlefield about this weaving. And I also was telling, I had a very hard time right here. It, you know, you can see I had a difficult time right there. And I was telling her about what a hard time I had of coming in from the outside. And after I quit talking to her, I don't know, it was quite a few days later, without anything, you know, and but that's how Indian people talk to one another, too, and she said, you know, that's really strange, that you would start on the outside and come in. She said, in beadwork, you have to come, start from the center and work out. Then everything fits together. If you start on the outside, everything bulges up, nothing comes out right. So when I started this one, I thought about it, and so I started here, and it was amazing. Once I got the ovoid in, the U-shape it just was right there. It just fit right in. It was just no problem. And the same thing with this ovoid here. I mean, I started here, and this ovoid just shaped. There was no problem with getting it to do what I wanted it to do. And so I'm really convinced that, you know, with Chilcat, that's how you have to do it.
Start in the center and work out.
And work out, and not the other way around, because everything is very hard to make come together, and you can see from my line, it was really hard to get that to all flow after. But once I got here, and I've tried it with the face, everything starts falling into place.
Well, can you think of any things that you might have learned from your mother that really helped you with your work and that you were trying to pass on now also when you teach? I mean, even things that would help you in your weavings, Chilcat weavings.
Well, I think that one of the things that she taught me that's really important, and I had a very difficult time because I had been taught to think with a pencil and paper and write out my design. That's why it's easy for me to do Chilcat, because I could look at it and know what they want me to do.
But in basketry, where you get a design and you know, this is her basket, they never really got excited if there was a little variation in, like if one was a little bit smaller than the other. It didn't bother them. And you'll look at old baskets in museums, and you'll see that. And it, they never really got upset about it. It, you know, because you have to turn it around to see where this happened. And, you know, they didn't really get upset about it. I mean, and so that's one of the things I used to get really, everything had to be precise because I was an accountant. Everything had to work out perfectly. And I used to really work at it, and she'd get really annoyed with me. I'd work it out on graph paper. And I think that, and she would say, like when you want a hat, the shape of a hat to form, she'd say, visualize it in your mind. Look at it in your mind, not just think about it, but see it the way you want it to be, and that's the way it'll turn out to be. I think that's important. I think to do something when you're creating an art piece, I don't care what it is, if you can visualize what you want to achieve, you'll get it. But if you just go at it haphazardly, you know, and thinking, you know, this is how I want it to be, it's not going to be whatever you want it to be. In fact, I had a hat I cut up that I had that happen with, because you don't use a form. You know, most Haida baskets, you use a form. It could be a little disc, but
like the one that's in the cylinder there has just...
No, that's when it travels. It's a stick in there, but... No, I'll get the... Let's see, I have a thing that my mother used to use before she started teaching. It's a little thin. I'll run up and get it. I left it buried behind my daughter moved to Hawaii, and she left all her things, so it's really a mess up there. I have to dig it out.
Okay.
I did it tied up and with and just some trees.
Oh, okay. So there was suspended.
Right,
or held
it was
up.
Suspended and they stood.
Okay. And they stood. Oh, yeah. How tiring.
I don't know if it's in crossword. Then I think they have it. I don't know where I saw them.
With the patch at the end, at the top, and just hung
there. And I wonder when that was taken.
Oh, that was during the Jessup expedition.
What was that?
I think it was 1899, something like that.
And this is a cousin of yours?
My cousin's great-grandmother.
Oh, I see, okay.
Frieda Diesings, because she has that bracelet.
Does she?
Yeah, when she saw this picture, she said, that is like my grandmother. So we figure it's her great-grandmother because that bracelet, she owns that bracelet.
Mm-hmm.
Now.
So what do you try and pass on to your students then that might have come down through your mother besides just techniques? Are there some stories or...
Well, a lot of the things that I try to pass on is feeling good about what you're doing. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a woman in Petersburg who wrote a poem about this, and she won an award in September and went to Washington, D.C. and got the award because she was doing basketry one night, and the last line was, it's making a basket case out of me, or something like that. We never had the poem, but you might have it there. I'll have to look it up. Anyway, she took a class and she said it's therapy of sorts, and it's really a neat poem. Let me see if I can find it.
Okay.
But it was some from Toronto, and I said to her, I said, can I use your poem to end my slide presentation? And she had read it to me, and I said, and so I had to, so she called me back from Toronto. And she was Canadian born, and I didn't know it at the time. And so to complete my slide presentation, I read her poem.
Huh.
Well,
I go out every year, except last year I broke both wrists and one time or another.
Hmm.
It was really terrible. It was a terrible year. I couldn't believe it. I had a terrible time financially and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Really awful. To break both wrists.
At different times?
Yeah, I broke both bones. Mm-hmm. Looking for a red nail cedar bark in the spring, and then 6 months later in November, I was walking down the hill returning videos because there was. I was going to get a second opinion because they were considering operating on his arm. And I there was some black ice in November, and I didn't see it, and I didn't see it.
Mm.
Well, it was, mm-hmm. It was terrible.
Yeah. And then, just, you know, whatever you can think of that you might like
I don't
to
know. Yeah, do you want my resume or?
Sure.
I gave a talk in at I don't know if some of these are on for publication. This is a talk I gave at an Alaska Native Women's Conference in Juneau last spring. I can't remember what I said, and it may not be good.
Okay, well, I would rather have you say something than to just copy what you have in here.
Okay.
But can I take this and at least read it? Maybe it
sure.
will give me some little bit more background. If I have a question out of this,
okay.
I can ask you. I mean, I can.
Sure.
She said, "Your brother's room is always neat. The bed is always neat." She said, "You shouldn't do that." And I said, "Ethel, you're hired to pick up after him." And my dad is out in the hall, and my dad said, "Dolores, I'd like to speak to you in my office." And so I had to go down and. He said, "I want you to sit down." He said, "Ethel is not there for your convenience. Ethel is there for your mother's convenience. So in the future, you will clean your own room." And he never, ever did love her come into my room again. I had to do it. And he'd come in and look and make sure it was clean. But I learned, like all kids, you could stuff a lot of things under your bed.
Oh, yeah.
Put a comforter on.
My daughter's learning that now. She's 4 years old. We decided on her very early about cleaning her room.
Uh-huh.
And she usually throws it all under her bed or in the closet. After going through, "Oh, well, that's not where it belongs. I think I'm where it belongs."
So we learned very early that the cook and the housekeeper and the person who came and carried wood was not our personal service.
Right.
Couldn't see when the food touched their mouth. So,
oh,
it's really lots of.
The hats were made just for eating?
No, the hats were made for being used in the rain and using, you know, at different ceremonies. But a lot of times they did not want, especially if they were mourning or if something was wrong, they were ill, they didn't want people to see them eating, so they would wear their hats.
And cover them.
Uh-huh. Right.
Oh, that's, I never knew that.
Yeah, and so, and then, especially because women had Lebret's mother said it was really disgusting to see them eat when she was a child, because they would have a hole where the plug was, and food would drain down. She said it was disgusting, and that's probably why, too, when they used the hats, nobody could see that this was happening.
Mm-hmm. So would they take the Lebret out when they were eating? Or?
No, it had to stay, because otherwise all the food would flow right out, anything that was, water, anything. And she said that sometimes they just held the Lebret and held it when they were the older women. And
your mother didn't have a Lebret.
No,
they
stopped that, right.
And she was a child.
And just the older women had it. The missionaries stopped it.
Oh.
And she was really glad they had it.
Yeah, really. Did they have tattooing at all?
My grandmother did, but she used to keep a real high, one of these blouses. In those years, they used to have blouses that had that high collar.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of like turtleneck, but it was fully on the top.
Mm-hmm.
It had a lot of
fill-in
lace. She always had those, and she always had a lot of lace down here. And she would never let us ever see her undressed. She always was fully, she had wore these long dresses, and she always wore sleeves that came down here.
Well,
but
did she have tattoos?
Right, but we could see the tattoos, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know why, and I think she must have had one up here because she had her whole, and you could see parts of it when she wore a lacy thing, you could see the tattoo.
Oh, yeah, interesting. I remember once, a long time ago, it was in the early 70s, I saw a woman. I was working at Nordstrom at the time for a couple of months. I just saw her and I noticed an old woman came in there and she had some tattoos on her chin. That's the only time I've ever seen of anyone with tattoos. I don't even know if there are any old people left that still have tattoos or not.
I don't know either.
Okay, so let me photograph this.